Good morning. My name is Corey. I'm on the pastoral staff here at Hope. Hey to those of you over at Hope West, worshiping over there. Glad to have you with us. I'm going to start out today by addressing a couple things that are happening in our world and in our nation. I want to do that because I think there's a storyline that gets connected to the church at times that I want to make sure we're able to speak to. And I think the storyline goes like this. The church is disengaged, disconnected from the world. It might have its place, but that place is on a Sunday. It really has no connection to real life. I don't know if you ever crossed that storyline or experienced that in your own life. Does the church have relevance to the world? And so I want to pause to highlight both the situation, the earthquake, the devastation in Nepal, and also the unrest of Baltimore. And I think I would have done this if it didn't dovetail into today's passage from the Gospel of Luke, but I believe it does. I believe there's connection. I don't believe I'm making a stretch to connect what happens with Jesus and the centurion to some of the events that are happening in our world. I am going to attack these things and come at them from a place of, if you're looking for a solitary word, just authority. We're going to talk about authority today. God as being authoritative over the world and the events of the world and earthquakes. And then with regard to Baltimore, looking at God being authoritative in civic life, political life, governance, right? And those having authority in our world and sometimes abusing that authority. And that's going to then move us forward into today's passage where the centurion has some measure of authority, and yet he looks to Jesus as having a different type of authority. And then I hope to end by just talking about, so what? What does that mean for us in our lives? Because I think some of us in this room, sit under authority in different times, in different places, in different roles of our lives. And there are many times where we actually sit in positions of authority. And so I want to be able to come back to that and talk about what does this mean for us here now. But let me just first start by talking about Nepal. And I don't know how saturated your mind and heart has been with the news coming out of that part of Asia. I don't know how full your news feed is. I don't know if you have fatigue about just hearing some of the devastation. My goal is not to add to that, but I do think there's just this identification, this awareness, this willingness to say to them, we see you, and our heart hurts for you. I don't know that any one of us in this room are going to find ourselves in Nepal in the near future. I do have a friend who, as coincidence would have it, he was scheduled to go and to serve and to be there, unrelated to these events, and he just happened to find himself on a plane heading there this past week. I think most of us are going to experience this event from afar, and I think as a result of that, we could close off our eyes or our ears or our hearts to that. And yet I think it's the call of the church, it's God's call for his church to have eyes open and ears open and hearts open to the needs of the world, to the devastation. Not that we might only go and serve and be a part there, because not everybody's going to have the means to do that. Not everybody's going to have time and availability to do that. And yet, I think there's still a call to pray for the people of Nepal, to bring them before God. And again, this plays into our view of authority and God's role in permitting, causing these events to happen. Permitting this devastation. Some of you may not want to come to God right now. That might not be your natural instinct to be drawn to God. Why? I don't know why he didn't stop this, and so I don't know that I want to come to him. If he has authority, why would he allow this? Why would he cause this? Why wouldn't he stop this? And yet it's exactly what I want to encourage you to do. It's what our passage is going to encourage us to do. Look what this Nepali pastor says through the Gospel Coalition and their international outreach arm. This tweet went out. Pray for Nepal. He's quoted as saying, "My heart is sad, but God is in control. Many trained leaders have been lost. Pray that God opens hearts." That in 140 characters or less is what this pastor on the ground is asking us, right? Empathize with us. My heart is sad here as I see the devastation. I think we can all say our heart is sad just in hearing this news, not even being there firsthand, but just hearing it secondhand, seeing the images brings us to a place of sadness. But what's his response? God is in control. God is in control. Do you believe that this morning? Right after speaking of sadness and God being in control, he acknowledges the fact that we've lost leaders. Recent numbers, some 7,000 lives being lost. That's brothers and sisters in Christ and many more Nepali people. He's saying we have leaders in our churches that have been lost. And yet this is what he concludes with. Pray that God opens hearts. Pray that God might use this to draw people to himself. Is that our mindset? Is that our hearts? Are we willing to pray for not only this pastor, but the people of Nepal with like prayers? God, our hearts are sad, but you are in control. We believe that this morning. And God, though lives have been lost, lives that are meaningful to you, every single one of them, deeply meaningful. Everyone, God, that you knew by name, that you formed in their mother's wombs, that you brought forth with giftings and talents to be expressed in your world. God, you cared about every single one of them. And somehow, God, bring forth good, bring forth fruit, bring forth open hearts that would turn to you in this time. Will we pray for Nepal? Will we do that? That's all I'm asking for us as a church. If there's something in you that wants to give, we have organizations that we're connected with. We're connected to the Evangelical Free Church of America. You can go to their website. You can click. Each of these websites have banner ads. Click on this their main link here, and they'll be able to talk about how their organization, a partner ministry of hope, is serving the people of Nepal. Same with Converge, which is another denomination that we are a part of. We're a part of two different denominations, because that's how we roll. And this Equipping Saints for Ministry, we're looking to actually send people with that organization soon as part of leadership development, as part of exposure to missions. And so any one of those would be great organizations, trustworthy organizations about how they're going to spend your gifts. And at the end of today's message, I do want to pause just to pray for Nepal and for those people there. Even reading the story of a pastor who, you know, shows the one picture, him and his wife, just smiles on their faces in front of their house, and the next picture is just, his house is just in ruins. And just my heart goes out to that guy. Just the absence of control that he has. He just... Let me turn the page now and talk about Baltimore for a moment. Many pictures, many stories, many criticisms, my Facebook newsfeed has just been lit up. And I've struggled. I don't know if you've struggled as you read through those. I'm thinking I need to take up a position. Seems like people are taking sides. If you're anything like me, you're kind of scratching your head going, I don't know which side I'm on. I don't know what to do. It seems like there's some battle lines, and it seems like I'm supposed to declare for one side or the other, and yet I have this internal struggle. I don't get it. I don't know which side I should land on. If these are the lines, okay, so let's imagine we have authority figures on the left-hand side there, and we have demonstrators, protesters on the right-hand side, and then we have media in the middle there. Not helpful. But let's just say that those are the sides. That's an oversimplification of the problem. But let's just say those are the sides. You have those in authority, okay? And those in authority having potentially some within this group of authority abuse that, misuse their power. And then you have the protesters, demonstrators, many of whom have brought forth honorable demonstrations and some who have not. So I'm seeing on these two battle lines, actually four groups of people, not just two, right? On the left-hand side, I have those in authority who have exercised that with honor, with nobility, maybe, and those that have not. And beyond that, I'm not able to discern down to individuals. I just have two groups of people within authority, those who have dealt and held that authority with honorable intentions and carried that out, and those who have not. And then on the right-hand side there with the protesters, demonstrators, those who have done it very honorably, with noble intentions and carrying that out, and others who have resorted to ignoble means and devastation and violence. And I struggle then to side with one and turn my back on the other. I don't feel like I want to embrace either side of these fully, because to do so would turn my back on the other. And so I've been wrestling with this, trying to bring forth a word to encourage the church, recognizing that the spiritual issues involved are different than civic and political, different than the battle lines that are maybe drawn. Where do we fit as people of the cross? Where do we, as spiritual people, as church people who want to bring forth the kingdom of Jesus Christ in our world, where do we stand? I think we stand in the middle with the media people. We're in the middle. They got it right. Where do I get that from? 2 Corinthians 5 says this: therefore, if anyone is in Christ, they become a church person, they've upheld the values of Christ in this world. If you are in Christ, you're a new creation. The old is gone, the new is here. All this is from God, who reconciled us to himself through Christ and gave us the ministry of reconciliation, that God was reconciling the world to himself in Christ, not counting people's sins against them. And he has committed to us the message of reconciliation. We are therefore Christ's ambassadors, as though God were making his appeal through us. Christ came, right? Christmas, we talk about the incarnation, the fact that Jesus Christ, second person of the Trinity, comes forth, born of a woman, okay? Fully God, fully man. He dwells with us. He lives with us. He's in our midst. And in doing so, he's reconciling us to the Father, and he's also tearing down this wall of hostility between us that we might love God and love one another. And then after he reconciles the world to the Father and to one another, he says, now you do likewise. Be reconcilers. Carry forth this ministry of reconciliation. It's a tough task. It's a tall task. And as I was sitting with this, I was saying, God, what's one small way that I might be able to actually do this? How might I try this? I'm not saying I know how to ride a bike. I'm just saying maybe I could get on a bike with some training wheels and just take a step forward in this. What might this look like? And as I was considering these things, the Lord reminded me that in our gym, I'm in my office over at Hope West, and in our gym at Hope West on that very time, on that very day, on Wednesday or Thursday, there's a group of about a dozen African-American students that were using our gym. I don't think this is just a black-white issue. As I talked with some of the people that I'm going to list here, most of them would hold it up as a class issue, economic issue. I said, I'm going to go talk to them. I want to hear what they have to say. And so I did. I approached them as they're playing basketball and getting all sweaty. And I'm like, hi, I don't know how to do this. Hey, And so a few of them kind of peeled off. They were gracious enough to talk to me. And I just said, hey, I'm gonna have a chance to address the church on Sunday. And I just, with all the civil unrest going on with Baltimore and Ferguson, is there anything that you would want to share? I had the chance to address, you know, some thousand plus hope people. Is there anything you'd want to share? And one of the girls just thought about it for a little bit, and she just said, I don't even know what to say. It's like, I don't even know where to start. There's just so many layers to this, so many layers of complexity. The other one says, it's tough. I'm like, well, share more. She says, well, I'm mixed. My parents, I have one black parent, one white parent, so I'm mixed. I'm on both sides of the racial struggle. Still another says, at the end of the day, I think we just need to treat each other with decency. Like brothers and sisters, man, that's it. And so this group I found out was from the Minneapolis Urban League. And so they're all in their late teens, early 20s. And then I just happened to have to repair my son's eyeglasses. It's not a good idea to practice baseball with your glasses on. So a screw came out, and I had to go get them fixed. And there was a guy, I don't know, maybe 55, 60 years old, African-American guy, and I just said, I want to hear what this guy has to say. And shared that I'm a pastor, I'm going to be preaching. And I love what he had to say. He says, well, I'm a Christian too. And I'm a follower of Christ before everything else. I'm a follower of Christ before I'm black. I'm a follower of Christ before I'm a man. I'm a follower of Christ before I'm a husband. I'm a follower of Christ before I'm a dad. I'm a follower of Christ before I'm an employee. He starts preaching to me. Right there in the shop, you know? And he says, what I'm called to bring forth, what we're called as followers of Christ to bring forth, is the kingdom. And the kingdom includes every race, every economic group. We're called to bring that forth in our everyday lives. None of them, as was shared with me, protested. But I just want to make sure I'm hearing. I just want to make sure that I'm not just forming my own opinion based on what some media person, what some blogger out there. I want to hear from people. How are you experiencing this? I also thought it might be interesting to hear from those who are in authority, those who are asked to wear a badge, carry a gun. And so I approached one of the two cops that I know, and I just said, do you have anything that you'd want the church to hear? And this is what he said. It's a longer email than I'm able to read through all of it. He says, I'm struggling with what to say. Isn't that interesting? Because I held up kind of two groups of people. And where people have been really quick to speak, I feel like I'm hearing from different sides and different groups of people an unwillingness to speak quickly. There's people who have been a part of this struggle that are saying, I don't know where to start. And so I want to be careful in being quick to speak. I want to be quicker to listen in the midst of this. But he says this, I'm still struggling with what to say. I mean, there's a lot to say from a civic and political standpoint. I don't just want to throw a bunch of information out at you. And then he shares this example, okay? What does him being a cop in the Twin Cities mean and look like? Not just for him, but for his family. He says, I was involved in a critical incident that resulted in the death of a suspect. My wife's first question to me, after asking whether I and my partners were okay, was what the race of the suspect was, followed by an expression of relief when he was white. So this is a concern that he and his wife carry with them, that his actions as an authority could get misrepresented. That's something he carries with him as he carries his gun and wears that badge. He says, to give you a glimpse into the mind of a cop who is a believer, there are days I come home so frustrated with our broken society that I find myself just praying for Jesus to come soon. I sometimes feel like a soldier on deployment, on enemy ground and losing the war. Other days, I literally need my wife to pray with me through my day. It's easier for me now with 3.5 years on the job to understand how officers can get bitter and cold to the world. This isn't to say they go off and start violating people's civil rights, but they certainly aren't enjoying the job anymore either. This is tough. This is tough for those who feel like their authority is being neglected and unheard, and it's a struggle for those who are in authority that wear badge and carry gun. And so I want us, as we continue to move forward and consider this topic of authority in light of national events, in light of world events, there's no easy answers. And I think we're fooling ourselves as the church, wanting to move into this world, wanting to make a difference, wanting to be an impactful community and church in our world. I think we're fooling ourselves if we're bringing forth trite, easy answers. I think our best hope is to lead forth without all the answers, in a posture of humility, willingness to just listen to those who are struggling, who are in the midst of the struggle, to be ministers of reconciliation, as God might have us. I want to highlight one who's doing it, who's getting it right. It's one of our partner ministries called Hope Academy. Some of you know Hope Academy. We're a partner. Hope Academy is a partner ministry of Hope Community Church. I love what they're doing. Right over here on Chicago and Franklin, okay, is an urban school. We have multiple Hope people that serve and minister there, and we support, as a church, we support them financially, and people go over there and mentor students. We have people tutoring. Lots of opportunities to serve over there. But look what two of their staff were highlighted. It says, Peacemakers at Hope Academy. Greetings. This is from Russ Gregg, the dean of the school. He says, greetings. Two Hope Academy staff were recently recognized by the city of Minneapolis for the peacemaking work they've done. Fifth grade teacher Don Tyler was nominated for, and upper school administrative assistant J.C. Hildreth was awarded the 2015 Minneapolis Peacemakers Award. In the midst of increasing turmoil at home and abroad, we thank God for their outstanding examples and for the many other staff who are committed to sowing seeds of peace in our city. Join us in praying God will use these efforts to produce a harvest of righteousness in our community and beyond. And he went on to say some of the things they're doing with the students in an impactful spring break mission trip. There are people on the ground. There are people in our cities who are working hard to be that reconciling presence. And I hope we can join them in that. All of that is an introduction. That's heavy stuff. That's heavy stuff. I admit that. And I need a little bit of levity myself. And maybe you need a little bit of levity just to say, all right, where are we at? Where are we at in the gospel here? Where are we at in this message? And so let's go there now. Let's transition. I want to pray for Nepal. I want to pray for Baltimore. I want to pray for us as a church that wants to have presence and make a difference and have relevance in the community. And so let's go there. Just to get you caught up, maybe you're a visitor. We have dozens of visitors every weekend here. And so if you're a visitor, just to quickly get you caught up here. Jesus is born. He comes into the world at Christmas time. We talk about that, right? And then he grows up. We don't get a lot of his earthly life at that point as a young teen, as a teenager. But then he starts his public ministry. And he has just come off preaching the greatest sermon ever, okay, the Sermon on the Mount or the Sermon on the Plain. And Steve, over the past 4 weeks, has taken us through that. This is gospel proclamation at its finest. This is Jesus getting staged to just teach the people, okay? And then they're getting various responses to that message. And that brings us up to today's passage where we move from gospel proclamation to gospel demonstration. He was teaching, now he's going to do some stuff, okay? He's not just going to be able to talk and it's easier, right? Sunday talk is cheap. It's like, what does this look like come Monday morning? Well, Jesus is going to show us how he follows through in daily life, living this out. Okay? Today's message is called, What Causes Jesus to Marvel? Luke 7, 1 to 10. You can look there on your Bible. You can look at the insert. It's all there for you. There's an outline for you where you can follow along. So I'm going to read through this passage, then make some comments. And like I said previously, we got to ask, so what? What does this mean for us come Monday morning? What does this mean in our daily lives? So let me read for us. When Jesus had finished saying all this to the people, that's the Sermon on the Mount. He's done talking and teaching. So he's saying all this to the people who were listening. He entered Capernaum. There, a centurion servant, whom his master valued highly, was sick and about to die. The centurion heard of Jesus and sent some elders of the Jews to him, asking him to come and to heal his servant. When they came to Jesus, they pleaded earnestly with him. This man deserves to have you do this because he loves our nation and has built our synagogue. So Jesus went with them. He was not far from the house when the centurion sent friends to say to him, Lord, don't trouble yourself, for I do not deserve to have you come under my roof. This is why I did not even consider myself worthy to come to you. But say the word, and my servant will be healed. For I myself am a man under authority, with soldiers under me. I tell this one, go, and he goes. And that one, come, and he comes. I say to my servant, do this, and he does it. When Jesus heard this, he was amazed at him, and turning to the crowd following him, he said, I tell you, I have not found such great faith even in Israel. Then the men who had been sent returned to the house and found the servant well. All right, let's walk through this a little bit at a time, just making some notes. The beautiful thing is the parts of this passage that are open to speculation are not the main point, and Jesus' main point is just dead obvious, all right? That's the helpful piece for us. So let's go through this. Let's walk through it. When Jesus had finished saying all this to the people who were listening, he entered Capernaum, okay? So he's been out on this plane. He comes back to Capernaum. That's on the north side of the Sea of Galilee. So imagine the hub of Jewish life being Jerusalem, okay? So let's imagine Jerusalem is the equivalent of the Twin Cities. Jesus is up in Walker, Minnesota on Leech Lake. Okay, nowhere, middle of, you know, just nothingness. My grandma is going to be at the 11 o'clock service, so that's a joke for my grandma for later, because she's from Walker. okay, so he's coming to Capernaum, which is on the north side there, and he's been doing some ministry there. He's been actually ministering and healing people. And he's becoming quite well known. If you're looking for Nazareth, that's in the lower left-hand corner there, kind of south and west of Capernaum. Let's keep going. There, a centurion's servant, whom his master valued highly, was sick and about to die. A couple things here. Just some of you love your Jewish history. Others of you are less inclined. But a centurion just is a guy, is kind of working for the Roman Empire. He's got 100 soldiers under him. He and five of his other centurion friends kind of serve under this tribunal, okay? So they have this kind of various layers of authority. But he's on the outskirts of the Roman Empire, right? He's not one of the big shots here. He's out there as well. And it's interesting because one of his servants seems close to death. And in the equivalent passage in Matthew, it says he's paralyzed and about to die, okay? So now what is it? Is it that he just so loves this servant? Just they have this kinship, even though he's got 100 of them, like this is his special guy? Or is it just like, no, if this guy dies, I lose his services? We don't know. We don't know. The passage doesn't tell us. It could be a little bit of both, but we don't know for sure, okay? But it's clear that there's something there. There's this willingness to kind of set up this story of saying, no, I value this servant highly. Don't know if it's because of the work product. Don't know if because there's this kinship, okay? Moving on, it says, the centurion heard of Jesus and sent some elders of the Jews to him, asking him to come and heal his servant. In Matthew's account, again, just trying to highlight, some of you might you like doing the multiple accounts thing. It's interesting because in Matthew's account, they don't have like the religious leaders coming to Jesus. It just says the centurion went right to Jesus. Most likely, I think what we have is legit here in Luke. And yet both of them can be still be the same story, just told different ways, right? Like the centurion came. Well, who spoke to Jesus, the centurion or the religious leaders? It's like, well, both, right? Because if you look at kind of the language there, he sent some of the elders of the Jews to him, asking him to come and heal his servant. And so there's just the way the language is set up there, which communicates it's clearly this singular guy, not this group of religious leaders that are coming to Jesus. And some of that's lost maybe in our English translations, but just want to make that clear. These elders of the Jews, he's clearly saying, the centurion is saying, all right, I don't have an in with him, but you guys would. Why? Because you're all Jews. So let me send you for a little bit of help. You guys can be part of my entourage. I watched Mayweather Pacquiao. Talk about some weird entourages coming out. The Burger King character was in one of the entourages for Mayweather. And then Pacquiao had Jimmy Kimmel, who was struggling to keep a straight face. Like he was the grizzled strength behind, I don't know, weird, okay? But these elders, these religious leaders, elders doesn't mean just like old people, it just means religious leaders, people who have some authority within that sphere are going to come and bring this request to Jesus to come and heal his servant. Continuing on, it says, when they came to Jesus, they pleaded earnestly with him. This man deserves to have you do this because he loves our nation, has built our synagogue. So can you imagine this? What have we been describing as kind of going on there? It's like, well, the religious leaders are trying to figure out Jesus because they've had authority, they've had control, and now he's kind of throwing things into upheaval. He's healing people, and he's healing people on the Sabbath, and that's confusing them, and it's frustrating them, okay? And rather than calm down, Jesus is willing to exasperate the problem, exasperate, B, with a B, right? Or a P, exacerbate. Thank you, Matthew. Appreciate you, all right? So he's willing to increase the scope of the issue. He doesn't care. He wants to press it, okay? So now these religious leaders are called by this centurion, this Roman. It's like, well, what do we do here? He wants us to go. We want to have peace. He's helped us in our nation. He loves us. He loves us as a people. He even went so far as to contribute funds and monetary stuff that we might build a synagogue. Maybe he's not the only guy, but he contributed enough funds where we would say he built our synagogue. He gets naming rights. You know, we got Target Field, Target Center. This guy gets named Centurion Synagogue. Like that would be his, he would get to name the synagogue, okay? And so he's deserving, Jesus, for you to come and heal him. And again, maybe as well-intended to keep peace and to honor this guy as they are, it's incongruent with some of the things Jesus has been teaching. There's this kind of honor and obligation thing going on within the religious sphere that Jesus is like, that's not what I'm about. There isn't this have to. I have to go and heal him. He deserves it. The religious leaders are saying, he's worthy. He's deserving. He's fantastic. Let me read a quote to help us with this kind of environment. Joel Green is going to help us because what Jesus has been trying to bring forth is like, no. We love everybody. We even love our enemies, okay? And so when we do things, it's out of the grace of God and the mercy that we've been shown from God, we turn and love others. It's not a I have to love you, but rather we've been loved so greatly by God, we get to turn and love others, but that's clearly not what these religious leaders are bringing forth. Joel Green says this, it is critical to recognize then the basis on which these elders appeal to Jesus for assistance. They do not employ the language of kinship or need, nor do they frame their request with any language that one might regard as harmonious with the new dispositions and behaviors Jesus has outlined in the preceding chapter. That's the Sermon on the Mount. That's love your enemies. That's love all the people, okay? That's not how they frame it to him, though. Instead, they assume and propagate the insider-outsider categories of honor and obligation prevalent throughout the empire. Their words betray their captivity to a world system whose basis and practices run counter to the mercy of God. Jesus has just set up a kingdom principle that we are going to love other people, including our enemies. That's what he wants to bring forth. Why? Because that's what we see depicted on the cross. Even while we are his enemies, he dies for us. He didn't come, even though he was worthy of honor and worthy of being served, he didn't come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. So he's overturning this honor obligation system, saying, no, no, no. It's out of God's grace and mercy. How does Jesus respond? He went with them. Even despite the way that they qualified, he still goes. He went with them. He was not far from the house when the centurion sent friends to say to him, Lord, don't trouble yourself, for I do not deserve to have you come under my roof. That is why I did not even consider myself worthy to come to you. You see that? It's the words that these friends are bringing to him are kind of first person singular, right? I. They're delivering this message for the centurion. And he's not far from the house when the centurion sends friends. It's kind of interesting because it's like, well, I'm going to send these religious leaders to get Jesus to come and to heal. And then it's almost like, he has this moment of like, oh, he might actually come. Wait, I can't. That shouldn't happen. Like, wait, friends, you go and head him off. Don't let him get here, okay? Because I'm not worthy to have him come. Lord, don't trouble yourself is the message, right? I do not deserve to have you come under my roof. Wait, the religious leaders brought the opposite message. They said you were worthy and deserving. You're a great guy. We should name our synagogue after you as the primary financial supporter. You're our guy. You love our nation. And the way he perceives himself is like, no, I'm unworthy. I shouldn't have him come to my house, come under my roof. I didn't even consider the possibility that I would even come to you, let alone have you, like, invite you to take that journey to me. Look what Stein says here in his commentary. He says, no reason is given for this sense of unworthiness. We don't really know why he just feels so unworthy. To claim that this feeling of unworthiness was due to a sense of depravity, right, in a spiritual sense, or a sense of immorality, being a Gentile and not a Jew, a recognition of the contrast between himself and Jesus, or a sense of defilement is purely speculative. We don't know why he felt so unworthy, where these religious leaders clearly esteemed him as worthy. The passage continues, and this is it, friends, this is it. But say the word, and my servant will be healed. For I myself am a man under authority with soldiers under me. I tell this one, go, and he goes. And that one, come, and he comes. I say to my servant, do this, and he does it. Say the word. All you, Jesus, need to do is say the word. Heal. Release. Stand. Walk. This paralyzed, near to death servant of mine would get up and walk. Just say the word. That's all you have to do. Stein says, the centurion explained his faith in Jesus by giving an illustration of authority. If the centurion with his authority could simply order certain things done, how much more could Jesus as Lord do the same? True faith realized that God can heal apart from rituals, special ointments, touch, or monetary gifts to the healer. The centurion recognized that all Jesus needed to say was a single word. His faith in Jesus was absolute and unlimited. Even a single word from the Lord spoken at a distance could heal his servant. For the Spirit of the Lord was present with Jesus to heal. Just say the word. Say the word. Do we have that mindset? Does our faith resemble that? God, you can do this. In a moment, you can do this. Heal. Save. Do we have that mindset of God in his authority, in his power? Continuing on, when Jesus heard this, he was amazed at him. And turning to the crowd following him, he said, "I tell you, I have not found such great faith, even in Israel." Then the men who had been sent returned to the house and found the servant well. Jesus shows his authority, shows his power. He gets up and he walks. He gets up as he's been healed by Jesus. That authority is established. It's how so many of the great stories in the Bible end, like Jesus as healer heals. He actually says the word. I think it can be really challenging for us because maybe we pray that he would speak the word and he doesn't. Jesus demonstrates his authority. He heals the guy. But it's the faith of the centurion. This non-Jewish guy, this guy who's outside the bounds of the Jewish faith. Maybe sympathetic, maybe a God-fearer. But there's no insight in the word that says this guy's a follower of Christ. This guy has trusted him, believed him. We just see, he demonstrates the fact that, Jesus, you have authority. You can say the word. And it causes Jesus to marvel. Jesus was there from the beginning. He created all things. He knows all things. So I'm guessing this kind of language isn't used very often, right? That he's marveled, that he's amazed at something, right? Like he was there when the Grand Canyon, like he did all that, right? He did all the continental stuff and the oceans and the depths of the seas. He did all that. So it's just like, it's just normal. And it says this caused him to marvel, to be amazed. The comparison would be, imagine you leaving Centennial, and you got to get over to Hope Bus, and you pass Frat Row, and it'd be a roundabout way. You wanted to pick it up at Sanford, let's say. It's a beautiful morning. You want to walk, okay? It'd be Jesus coming to that person, Frat Row, the person, and you go, man, the partying, the drunkenness, things getting out of hand. And some person in there that just carried their pillow home, woke up to somebody they didn't know, expressed in their life that Jesus had authority to do something that far surpassed any of the faith being expressed by the people of this church. That's what's being described here. You know how offensive that is? It's those in our group in here that love hipster life, urban life, ride your bike only life, okay? And God comes and sees that soccer mom, suburban drive, SUV driving suburban mom, that one that you go, I would never live life like her. And God sees something in her where she establishes, she believes in the authority of God. The one that you find lowest of the low, that person expressing faith in God's ability and authority. You have somebody in your life that you consider other. To the Jews, that's this guy. And God marvels at his faith. That should challenge you. That should convict you. It does me as I've sat with this. I don't want that to be true of us. God finding more faith out there than in here. I don't want that to be true of us. Recalling Luke 4. Do you remember this? The Spirit of the Lord is on me. Do you remember Jesus' mission statement? We talked about it a few months ago. He has anointed me to proclaim to the poor and this one word, right? Good news. Do you remember when Steve did that and he did it laboriously and he did it over and over again? That the way that these sentences are structured, Jesus comes along to the poor and he says what? Euangelion, good news, one word. Or he comes to those who are imprisoned and he shouts one word, freedom. Or he comes to those who are blind and he screams one word, sight. Say the word, Jesus. Just say the word. And the centurion just says, Jesus, just say the word. You can do it. Just say it. Say it. And he does. And his servant is healed. Just say the word. This centurion is following these principles. He's holding Jesus to his word. That the Spirit of the Lord is on him to preach good news, to proclaim freedom, to proclaim sight. And I just want to bring it back to now Monday. Monday through Saturday, our lives. I think we have a struggle with authority. I was talking with a couple guys that we looked at this passage together on Monday, Davis and Mike, and we talked through just the struggle that we as Westerners, as Americans have with authority. We started a nation based on a struggle for authority. The United States, right? We don't want your authority. East, right? We don't want British authority anymore. We're done. Okay? We want freedom. We want to do our own thing. And that's built into you. This is in you. Because if I ask you to do something, your natural response is no. Right? Like that's the challenge I face as preacher every Sunday. Because it's just in you. That independent streak, nonconformist. You want me to do something? No, I just, no. Oh, it's okay for me not to come? Then I'll be there. I'll be, you know? Like that's, we're like hardwired. But then this gets interwoven throughout all the different areas of our life. I just listed some here, right? For some of you, you're under authority in school. And you're really feeling that professorial authority over you right now at this time of the year, right? Just like, why are they assigning all of this right at the end? What is that? They had all semester to lay down the smack, and they're waiting to the end, right? For some of us, it's at work. You might have some authority. You might be under authority. Civic authorities, we already mentioned. Governmental authorities. Family has different layers of authority to it, right? My wife, she holds our finances. I yield to her authority in that. She'll come to me and say, we need to have a spending freeze, right? Which is really, would not be a good time right now since we're in the middle of a basement renovation, so that'd be not good timing, right? And then there's other times where she'll yield to my authority. And the boys, 100% of the time, yield to my authority. But in family relationships, you have different structures. What about the church? Some of you have been burned by the church, been hurt by the church. Church has misused its authority in your life. That's hard. As a church, we want to be as transparent and vulnerable with you as you can. If you have a question about anything going on at Hope, you can, you should come talk to us. If you want to learn about our governance model, our leadership structure, if you want to hear, does Steve has just complete authoritative church as the senior pastor? Is he just above all things? No. We have layers of accountability, transparency. And so in all these different areas of your life, and maybe there's just one, I'm just going to ask you to focus in on one. You might actually be saying, God, will you just say the word? Will you just say the word? Will you just fix this? Will you just undo this? Maybe you have a little mini Baltimore happening at your work. Maybe you're not from this church and you have a mini Baltimore happening in your church. I don't use that lightly. Some of the worst fights are church fights. Some of you, this feeling where God's maybe not showing up, you're praying for him to just say the word and he hasn't. Causes you to just question the validity of the scriptures, the existence of God, the reality of the cross. I just want to speak to that as we come to God through song and communion this morning. I want to hold up two things. Number one, God can say the word. God can absolutely say the word in a moment, and sometimes he will not. But even when he doesn't mean that the first one's not true. Right? Go back in the prophet of Daniel, Rakshak and Beni, right? Our God is able to deliver us from this fire, and he will do it. And even if he doesn't mean that that's not true. That's our faith. That's our heart. That's our hope. Let me share from this Caring Bridge site. There's a person at Hope, and they have a loved one kind of going through some stuff, a father-in-law. And I just want to read, because this preached to me this week. She says this: yesterday we arrived at 6:30 a.m. with a surgery start time scheduled for 8:30. This guy's supposed to have open heart surgery. Our children were with us in person or spirit, and we kissed our beloved husband and father goodbye as he was wheeled into the OR. The kids and I huddled together in prayer on his behalf, asking God for the very best outcome. And if not, our God is still our God. We waited patiently in the ICU waiting room for him to be admitted in his room, and then we could see him with our own eyes. We waited, and then a nurse came in and told us he is arresting, and the doctors are working very hard to correct his failing heart. We fell to our knees and cried out to the greatest physician for his intervention. Heal, right? Just say the word. This was not the outcome we had hoped for, but it is the path our sovereign God has allowed. We could visit Ken for brief moments. He is unresponsive and brings us to tears as we see our strong dad and husband clinging to life. But God is still God on the throne, and he is our God. That is the faith of the centurion. That is the faith of this family. That, I hope, is our faith this morning. God, say the word, and even if you don't, you're still our God. Let me ask you two questions. Do you believe Jesus can say the word? And it will be so. Is that reflective of your heart and mind and faith this morning? Do you believe that? And secondly, do you still believe that even when it doesn't become so? We get the chance to take communion. And the communion is representative of Jesus definitively saying the word in regard to sin and death and brokenness. The cross screams God's love for you. If you're wondering this morning, is God there? Does he care about you? The answer is yes. He has said the word. He has saved you. And so as we come to communion, the bread represents his body being broken for you, and the cup represents his blood being shed for you. God cares about you. He has said so. At any point during these songs, I invite you to come forward, and at both East and West, we have opportunities to come forward. At East and West, we'll have people down front that are willing to pray for you. Over at West, we have people upstairs be willing to pray for you. We just want to invite you to come forward, to respond in faith to what God has done on your behalf. I'm going to pray now for us as a people, also for Nepal and for the needs we have. Will you pray with me?